I think it's a game changer for us to have these specific documents to really revise and improve our training programs.
It's just an exciting time to be a nephrologist. We have all these tools, and obesity is something that traditionally we haven't focused on, and I'm really happy to see this.
So if we utilize these tools, we can really help people, help them live better lives.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks, and I'm here with two guests to talk about a new initiative from the American Society of Nephrology called the ASN Kidney Health Guidance. This is the very first issue on the management of obesity in persons living with kidney disease. We have two guests who are co-first authors and corresponding authors of this manuscript, published in JASN. Dr. Alp Akisler, who is the division chief at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. We also have Dr. Holly Kramer, who is at the Loyola University in Chicago. Welcome to both of you to ASN Kidney Translation. Happy to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
First, what is the ASN Kidney Health Guidance?
The ASN Kidney Health Guidance is an initiative to promote high quality, person-directed care across the entire spectrum of kidney health and diseases. This is a pretty quickly established initiative and put into action. To tell you the truth, this has been on the discussion for about 18 months or so. The whole initiative started with an initial group of workforce members providing some insight and guidance to the ASN Council. We subsequently decided that they will get this initiative going and start with the initial question of how obesity impacts kidney disease and how it's managed in the setting of kidney disease. We anticipate that this initiative will be continuing over the long term, and there will be others that are coming. At least 3 or 4 a year is what we perceive and expect.
Why was obesity selected as the first ASN Kidney Health Guidance?
Well, obesity affects a very large proportion of the population. And we know that obesity is a major risk factor for kidney disease progression. Even people who have genetic diseases, we now know that obesity is a very important factor for progression of kidney diseases of all kinds, glomerular diseases, genetic diseases, and of course, diabetic kidney disease. So if we can try to address obesity as a kidney disease progression risk factor, we can further halt or slow the progression of kidney disease and keep people off of dialysis and prolong survival, decrease hospitalizations, decrease cardiovascular mortality by addressing obesity itself. But the other big issue is that obesity is one of the major reasons why people cannot get waitlisted for kidney transplant. And I've had many patients being turned down until they lose, 40 pounds, which is really, really difficult if you have kidney disease and you're fatigued, to try to get them to change their lifestyle and lose 40 pounds is incredibly challenging. But there's been some really great leadership across the country that have really shown that we can use the existing medications that we have to get people to lose weight. And we can also use bariatric surgical techniques to help people lose weight and get people transplanted. So there's been all this exciting research that has been happening across the country and globally. And we now know that we really have tools that can help people who have obesity that may be affecting their kidney disease progression or affecting their ability to get a transplant or affecting their quality of life. And so if we utilize these tools, we can really help people, help them live better lives. And so I think the whole point of the guidance is just to try to get people to utilize those tools. So anytime you have a guideline, as you guys know, it takes like 8 to 15 years before we really get people utilizing the tools that we have. And even then, you still have huge gaps in care with like ACE and ARBs for diabetic kidney disease, for example. So I think it's really important to try to emphasize what tools we have and encourage people to utilize them. And one of the big issues in the guidance statement is to say that we really need to educate nephrologists on the existing anti-obesity medications and on the pros and cons and who to select for bariatric surgery, how to really address the psychosocial aspects, how to even communicate with people about obesity. there's these huge educational gaps because, you know, it just really hasn't been something that we've been really focused on as a community. And then really a lot of that just has to do with the fact that historically, a lot of these tools have been contraindicated in our patients, right? But now we think that we can really implement these things safely. And so it's an educational gap that we have, and we're hoping that this guidance statement will help to fill that, but also just to kind of get people to start talking about it. You know, what are the gaps in care? What can we do to address those gaps in care? And how can we better educate each other on how to manage obesity?
It's just an exciting time to be a nephrologist. We have all these tools, and obesity is something that traditionally we haven't focused on. And I'm really happy to see this guidance come out. Alp, I'm just curious about this guidance. What was the makeup of the group who drafted this document?
As you will see in the document itself and the authorship list, it is a very comprehensive group of individuals with a lot of expertise in different areas. Of course, as expected, we try to pick individuals for this guidance document who have expertise in obesity as it relates to kidney disease and what happens in the setting of kidney disease. And as you read the document, you will see that we've divided it into four major areas of interest, including psychosocial aspects, lifestyle modifications, anti-obesity medications, and metabolic bariatric surgery. So obviously, we included found and included experts on those specific areas to lead specific work groups and populated that each section or work group with individuals or representatives from all stakeholders, including nephrologists, dietitians, physician extenders, and of course, as much as possible, patients. So we have ended up with an outstanding group of individuals who really delivered a phenomenal output.
And I'll add, in addition to having Dr. Sarwar, who's from Temple University, that has expertise in the psychosocial aspects of obesity and really has published many articles about the behavioral aspects and issues of anxiety and depression that often accompany obesity, especially when you have comorbid conditions, but also a patient. We have Dr. Ortiz, who is a patient who has polycystic kidney disease, and he also has a PhD in exercise science and really has a lot of knowledge of what do you do to try to motivate patients to get them to change their lifestyle. And we also had people who had a PhD in nutrition science. So we really had a really wide background of people who could add to the conversation. And it made for really good conversations, I think. It wasn't just nephrologists with interest in obesity. It was really people who have expertise in a broad range of areas and lived experience as well.
Well, that's great. And congratulations on getting this multidisciplinary group together and to achieve the document. It's wonderful. Yeah, I have to echo that one of the things I noticed about the document was the interplay between psychosocial considerations in obesity and the need to communicate with empathy, ensure mental health is addressed. All these things are really important. The other issue is that you already mentioned is that social determinants of health is also key to this. So you've mentioned a little bit about it, but what was the strategy that the group had for ensuring that these were successfully integrated into the guidance document?
So as far as ensuring that the psychosocial aspects were documented in the guidance statement, I would say that's like the first thing that we actually talked about. And we all shared stories of patients where we had tried to talk about obesity and maybe the approach hadn't been as successful as we had liked. And some of that has to do with how we communicate. And so there was a real discussion about communicating with empathy and not using terms like obesity, like fat or adiposity, or using terms that we might use sometimes, but really what we should be talking about is just weight loss, right? And thinking about that as a risk factor for whatever goals you're trying to achieve. But there's also then the issues of the psychosocial aspects of like anxiety and depression, maybe past experiences that might be influencing their lifestyle. And so we really tried to make sure that we had someone on the team who could address that. That was something that we thought first when we had our first discussions, you know, is to make sure that that was included. Because I think like if you look at a lot of the review articles, that aspect of how do you even approach a patient? And how do you approach a patient and so that they don't feel bad about themselves? And what we now know is a lot of people really feel insecure about their weight, maybe not feel comfortable about discussing it. And so one of the first things that we say in our guidance statement is to ask the patient, would it be okay if we talk about your weight as being a risk factor for X, Y, and Z, whatever goal it is that you're trying to achieve with the patient.
I really like that. That's a great approach to have. If I look at, I think it's figure one, has quite an impressive algorithm. Now, I don't want to go through it in excruciating detail. However, there's three key aspects where I think a nephrologist can get involved. And the first is lifestyle modification, diet and exercise. The second is the pharmacologic interventions with the anti-obesity medications, which has really created quite a number of options for nephrologists and other physicians. And then the last is bariatric surgery, which we've had that option for a while, and it seems like there's more and more refinement of the surgical technique. And so there's a lot to sort of to go through here. Maybe, Alp, can you tell us sort of like, as a nephrologist, when you're seeing patients, how do you deal with lifestyle modification, diet, and exercise? How do you tackle that?
Well, that's an excellent question because, as you all know, and you must know from your own clinical expertise, that each and every patient that comes to our clinic asks that question. How do I change my diet? What should I eat or not eat? Or how can I really improve my overall health? And again, what we do in general population and recommendations really apply to patients with kidney disease to the largest extent. However, because kidney disease is a disease of large spectrum and includes ones that have much more complications or comorbidities, such as the ones with advanced kidney disease or the ones who are on dialysis or the ones with a kidney transplant, I think it's really important to individualize and personalize these specific lifestyle modifications to the group of individuals with kidney diseases. What we try to do in this specific document is to give them the basic knowledge and understanding that lifestyle modifications is always a good thing, something that the patient should do, but they should do it as much as they can tolerate it and how it fits to their overall clinical condition. So our intent is to seek advice from experts as needed, provide our patients as the safest and the most effective ways of changing the lifestyle. Now, one thing we also do in this specific document, which is a little bit of a change in our understanding, is that in addition to lifestyle modifications, there are many other opportunities to really increase the efficacy and impact of these changes, such as the anti-obesity medications and metabolic bariatric surgery.
Talking to a patient and just asking them, is it okay if we talk about your weight? And then you could just ask, do you think there are issues that could be affecting your lifestyle? Maybe you're caring for an elderly patient. Maybe your husband or your spouse is ill, or maybe there's substance abuse issues. Right, there's a lot of issues that could be affecting their lifestyle that could be psychosocial. And I think it's nice to just have a conversation with them. Obviously, if you have a 20-minute that you can work with the patient, you're not going to be able to solve their problems. But you might be able to determine if you should refer them for psychologic counseling or to substance abuse disorder clinic or something like that. Or reach out to their primary care physician and coordinate care regarding mental health issues. And then the other thing about the lifestyle, as I mentioned, is this collaborative approach. And of course, it's really going to depend upon the resources that you have. So every clinic, every health system has different resources. Some have more, some have less. And I think you have to really understand what are the resources that you have. So for example, I work at the VA, and I think we have a lot of resources that we can use to influence lifestyle, and they're probably underutilized. We have the Move On program, we have Whole Health. So those are something you can think about if you are fortunate to work at some place that has a lot of resources. But you also have places where there's really limited resources. But at a minimum, you know, get the patient to talk with a registered dietitian. And we had Elizabeth Yates Jimenez, who's a PhD in nutrition, and she is at the University of New Mexico. And, you know, she really talked about how we really need to get more patients to talk with registered dietitians. And of course, you may lack registered dietitians who have expertise in obesity or expertise in kidney disease. But again, this is like a policy issue that this kidney health guidance statement can really help bring out the issues that we don't have enough registered dietitians who have expertise to specifically help our patients who have both obesity and kidney disease. But still, I would still say meeting with a dietitian should be always considered, you know, in the prime of lifestyle modification, you know, and that's covered by Medicare with no cost sharing as well.
Something that's really created a lot of excitement, and that's the pharmacologic management, where we actually do have drugs now that appear to be safe and actually have improvements in kidney outcomes and cardiovascular disease, notably the GLP-1 receptor agonist and the combined GLP-1 receptor agonist with GIP receptor agonist. So let's go ahead and talk about these, because I know that as the nephrology community, we are excited about the ability to prescribe a medicine like this that not only helps a person lose weight, but really has a positive impact on their entire health.
Again, a very important question that has a lot of implications, how we really improve the well-being of our patients with kidney diseases. Nephrologists are really thorough and very much involved in the care of our patients. So there's not much time for us to really think about things that are out of our usual care. But I think given their overall impact and the way that they can really change the overall public health associated with these anti-obesity medications, I think we should get involved. And there's a level of involvement that we should really pay attention to. It is not intent to say that one nephrologist should really take over all the care, but also at the same time, do not completely exclude yourselves from the care of the patient who needs these medications. So the most important recommendation we make is to seek advice and collaboration with our colleagues and other healthcare providers, such as the dietitians and social workers and others. So the only way to do this is to understand the importance, know the benefits, and then apply what is suitable for the patient in terms of the patient's overall condition, as well as insurance and other things.
I think towards the end, you mentioned about enhancing obesity management training and education for nephrologists during fellowship. And I love that portion right there, because how we sort of teach fellows is really going to be a long-lasting blueprint for how they practice medicine. And in that vein, I have heard, and people are reluctant to prescribe GLP-1 receptor agonists because of the complexity of dose escalation and side effects. How does this document help reduce that barrier that is out there in the community?
Well, again, an excellent question. All three of us are in academic institutions, have a huge commitment to training our fellows and our other needs. And I think we sit in a very important opportunistic time in terms of really making a difference in terms of how we train our fellows. First of all, incorporating the guidelines and guidance documents such as this require early exposure for the practicing physician to really take advantage of them. And that could start at medical school and onwards. Obviously, for us as nephrologists, the biggest opportunity is during fellowship. I think we should really talk to our fellowship directors and encourage them to change the curriculums to include formal training regarding the types of documents that are relatively scarce in our discipline, such as guidance documents. I think it starts from there. So if we have these documents that are available to us, which is an indirect effect of this guidance initiative, that there's going to be more need and expectation for the training programs to really incorporate ways of understanding the differences between guidelines, guidance documents, and how we can really do in practice. So I think it's a game changer for us to have these specific documents to really revise and improve our training programs.
It's time for us as a community to take this on, and this guidance is the perfect impetus to make that happen. Now, also, I know nephrologists love evidence-based medicine. Holly, can you sort of briefly go through some of the evidence surrounding these novel medications for weight loss?
Sure. So the most recent FLOW trial that was published in the New England Journal a couple months ago randomized people with who had chronic kidney disease. So everyone had increased urine albumin to creatinine ratios in this study. And then the primary outcome was either kidney failure or 50% decline in glomerular filtration rate. And the study was stopped early because of the fact that they met their endpoint and was a 24% relative risk reduction in the primary endpoint for those who got the GLP-1 receptor agonist versus the placebo group. Now, when you talk about these medications, I think one of the things is to not forget about the importance of lifestyle. I'm sure Alp would agree that if you combine lifestyle with that, you're going to get more bang for your buck. So if you just take the patient and you put them on this medication, you may not get as good of weight losses as if you get the patient to exercise, especially if you get them to follow a prescribed diet. So I think just remember that to use lifestyle combined with the medications. And then the other aspect of the medication is to think about the safety. And I think we really spent a lot of time discussing the safety of the medications, especially when you're using it in people who have advanced chronic kidney disease or older people, where you're really concerned about the nutritional intake. One thing to think about when you think about these medications, kind of like using allopurinol for gout, we always say, you know, start low, go slow. Same thing with these medications, you know, just be really cautious in how fast you escalate the dose, really ask the patient about their symptoms, and really try to make sure that the patient is taking in enough calories and nutrients that they need to stay healthy. So getting them to be working with a registered dietitian, but don't just start the medication and, you know, like you would with an ACE inhibitor. You really have to think about what are the things that you can combine with that medication to enhance safety and to enhance efficacy.
Well, what study that you mentioned, Holly, was the FLOW trial. And the one thing about the FLOW trial was all the patients had diabetes. And we've mentioned diabetes in this podcast with obesity. However, the biggest problem that we're facing now is the inability of insurance companies to pay for these drugs in patients that don't have diabetes. My question is, do you think that a guidance statement like this will have any teeth to actually change policy to allow us to prescribe these medicines across a wider group of patients?
Well, I think that the guidance statement is a start in getting the conversation rolling. But yeah, there's going to be a huge policy need, not just for anti-obesity medications to be covered by insurance companies, but so many other things that we really need in the nephrology space to improve clinical care. I mean, just like we lack payment for nurse educators, you have diabetes educators, you know, who spend time and counsel patients and educate them on their disease. And we lack that for kidney disease. And we need more registered dietitians. We need better access, especially in rural areas. We don't have payment for physical rehabilitation of patients. Huge issue, right? So if you have a heart attack, then you can go and get physical rehabilitation. But if you initiate dialysis, which is extremely traumatic, there's no physical rehabilitation. It's just huge policy issues. And I think that the guidance statement really helps to elucidate a lot of these holes that we have in care. And I know that ASN is really dedicated to moving the policy issues that the guidance statement, this one specifically, emphasizes, including those issues that you just mentioned, you know, about the anti-obesity medications not being covered by insurance for many groups.
A very important, very relevant issue for our patients with kidney diseases. How do we really make the policymakers to understand the importance and the relevance of these management strategies? And then in reality, we all know, the whole work group actually knew that we were a little bit optimistic. Not, I wouldn't say even a little bit, but we're really shooting for the moon in terms of really getting the best care for our patients. And what we've learned over time is that the policymakers actually really like to help the patients too. They just don't have any opportunity or guidance. And in nephrology, these kinds of initiatives such as guidance documents will really allow the policymakers to take them and take it back and say, hey, you know, this is what the experts recommend and this is what we should do. So I think we're in, a very critical point in time where we're really recognizing, probably taking some of the expertise from other disciplines like cardiology and oncology, where we really take advantage of these documents to change policy in the future. And that, I think, will be an important long-term impact of these guidance documents that are to come, including the one that we have written on obesity.
That's wonderful, and I'm hopeful that these guidance documents will do that. Before we move on to metabolic and bariatric surgery, there are other drug pharmacologic agents that are listed in this document, and I don't think we have time to go over each individually, but I wanted to at least give both of you the opportunity to mention something about these, because oftentimes patients, for whatever reasons, cannot take GLP-1 receptor agonists or GIP receptor agonists. And so they're the opioid receptor antagonist, naltrexone and bupropion combination, orlistat, and then phentermine topiramate combination. So those are the three other drugs that were mentioned in this document. Any comment on those three and how they can be used in patients with kidney disease?
The intent of our document is to provide some educational resources to our practicing colleagues as well. Those medications have been around, and interestingly enough, and unfortunately, our knowledge about these medications, their availability, their efficacy, as well as their safety is very limited. So this document really lists those drugs that have been discussed and gives the actual findings about them. So without really pushing anyone one direction or the other, I would highly recommend that people actually go back and read those parts and get a better idea and more informed information or more informed knowledge about when to use or not to use. That way, one can really do things. And again, the beauty of the document is it's short, it's to the point, it's accessible. So you can actually go back to your clinic, and if a patient asks, you can easily, within a couple of minutes, you can log into ASM website and find that information and provide the information that's necessary. That actually reflects to our algorithm too. We've included an algorithm for people to have practical on-the-spot guidance of what to do rather than go back and read a huge comprehensive document that doesn't really provide on-the-spot information. And I think that really is the difference between a guideline and a guidance. I would like to emphasize that the value of guidelines is enormous. We should always refer to them, but they're usually black and white, and they are not too flexible in the sense of how to really manage patients that are not clear. So guidance documents actually provides you the opinions and the suggestions. It is, of course, up to the practicing provider how to use them.
I mean, if I look at the table two, beneficial outcomes for the three classes that I just mentioned have big question marks on the kidney, heart, and survival. So just wanted at least to mention those because they are included in the document. And the other areas that SGLT2 inhibitors also, you have some weight loss, and I'm happy to see that was included. So flozinating is so important. And so I'm happy that it was mentioned. So let's move on to bariatric surgery. Tell us about bariatric surgery and now with these new medications, how do we consider this into our patients and what's the evidence surrounding bariatric surgery?
As we were writing this document, I myself have learned a lot. I was informed and learned that bariatric surgery is available since the 1950s, and it is a very well-established and effective way of weight loss. There are certain issues that are attached to the bariatric surgery. Number one is that it is a specific procedure that is only available at certain centers. So in order to have access to those, you have to be in a very specific area that provides that holistic weight loss management. Number two, it comes with a number of different, I wouldn't say side effects, but changes, metabolic changes that require close attention, especially in terms of nutrient intake, electrolytes, and other things. So for a nephrologist, for someone who have kidney disease, these additional metabolic changes represent another layer of attention. So if we refer someone to metabolic bariatric surgery, we have to understand that it is effective. It can actually be used with certain anti-obesity medications at the same time, but it requires more close follow-up for safety reasons from a nephrologist.
I really like the inclusion of Table 4, which is this kidney-specific metabolic and bariatric surgery checklist. I like it because it's succinct, and for a nephrologist who has a patient that's considering that, really helps sort of ensure that you're covering everything that's needed to be covered for a patient both before and after the surgery.
I will go back and refer to my comment about practicality, accessibility in terms of guidance documents, that they have to be easy and understandable. That Table 4 represents that concept. You know, what we do not have in clinic in general in nephrology or for patients with kidney disease, those kinds of documents will really make our lives easier and more efficient as we take care of a patient. We think that table four, as well as the algorithm for the management of the patient with obesity, will be an invaluable resource that will really make the practitioner's life easier. So that document is intended to be inclusive, but of course there may be parts that are not really completely covered. But I think those guidance documents that have those kinds of attributes will really make a big difference in the practicing nephrologist's life.
Yeah, I would say shout out to Alan Friedman, who's really been a person who's kind of spearheaded the importance of bariatric surgery for helping patients get transplanted and improving the quality of life of even patients who are receiving dialysis. And I think what we could do, an easy step, is just find out where and who is doing bariatric surgery at your health center and try to see if you can talk with them. Because what I've seen is that most bariatric surgeons that I've talked to don't feel comfortable doing surgery on someone who has kidney disease, especially advanced kidney disease. So I think it's really, we really need to have more communication with the surgeons and try to help advance the access to this, because people who are experts in this area and who are willing to do surgery on our patients so that it can be successful. And there's many, many case reports, case series showing that bariatric surgery can help patients get transplanted.
Now, with the availability of all these other pharmacologic agents, is metabolic and bariatric surgery becoming more of a second tier option or third tier option?
A very important question that goes back to this personalized approach. In general, we want to treat everyone with what's available to us and make it as easy as possible. But a patient with kidney disease and a weight that is not appropriate for their overall health, you have to understand that that patient is complex. And I think this document will allow patient individuals and patients as well to really make the right decision what would be the first thing to do. I will tell you another fact that we should probably take into consideration is that those anti-obesity medications come with a lot of side effects, concerning rate of dropping the patients from the therapy, like 25 to 30% not being able to maintain that. So these are not silver bullets that take care of everything. They have to be used in combination with the best suitable way. And I will like to emphasize this, not to lose weight, but to achieve a weight that is suitable and appropriate for the patient's age, gender, and existing comorbidities. That should be our goal.
Can we go through some of the side effects, especially in patients with kidney disease, that can happen in patients that get metabolic and bariatric surgery? I think those are important to highlight as well.
I think the most important one, as we all know, is these absorption of certain electrolytes and other things. So there has to be some follow-up in terms of different electrolyte composition, hypokalemia, and other things. But in addition to that, we know that there's a problem in oxalate absorption, a huge risk for kidney stones. So that needs to be taken into account, and patient needs to change their diet, and there has to be a close follow-up on that. In addition to that, a bariatric surgery is a radical procedure without a return back, especially if you really do the gastric bypass, which means that the absorption of certain macronutrients and micronutrients will not be the same. So we want to make sure that the patients are not at risk for poor nutritional intake. And this is more important and more relevant for individuals with advanced kidney disease, where there's a significant amount of other catabolic processes that occur. So at that point, I think the best would be to ask advice and help from our dietitian colleagues. I would say no bariatric surgery patient should be managed alone without a dietitian in close collaboration.
Well, now that we're coming to an end to this episode, I am really excited about this. I think as a community, we're all behind this and we're fired up about it. This document helped push us in the right direction. So thanks to both of you and the group for really working hard on this. Any last words that you want to say about the guidance to the nephrology community?
The guidance statement really is more of an ideal statement. We recognize that their resources might be limited where you practice. So you might be at a place where you don't have all of these aspects that we discussed, and you have gaps in insurance coverage for the anti-obesity medications. And we understand that. So I think the guidance statement is really kind of meant to be like, if we had all these resources, here's the optimal management that we would prescribe, right? But have to be cognizant that there are policy issues that need to be addressed to try to improve the care and the access for our patients. And so we're really kind of starting off with this is a kind of our dream picture, but we understand that there's gaps and we need to keep pushing on this. And I really like what you said, Dr. Sparks, about how the importance of educating our fellows on this. And I think that's just hugely important, because just like you said, if you educate our fellows, then you're going to be transforming the care in the future. And maybe in the future, we will have better insurance coverage of these medications, higher access to bariatric surgery, more access to physical rehabilitation and exercise therapists and registered dietitians. And so I think we really need to stay optimistic that we can really improve this aspect of care.
I would like to echo what Dr. Kramer said. I would like to add a couple of other words. One is that I cannot be more excited about this. It represents a huge opportunity in our community for patients with kidney diseases. And we have to thank the American Society of Nephrology, the leadership, for taking this initiative and allowing us to be a part of it. Number two, this is a very important area. We know, I've just read in the news that obesity hit a 20% threshold in the United States. And our patients are really predisposed to this problem. So I think it's going to be a very impactful clinical initiative. And three, most importantly, we have a gap in terms of availability of guidance documents. We had to start from somewhere. And this is a major leap towards betterment of the care of the patients with kidney disease, with the availability of this and future guidance documents. I will tell you that there's much more to come in the next couple of months to a year. And we would love to see this initiative growing and others participating into this. And then I'd like to finish up by thanking to several individuals, but most importantly, Sarah Sampson, who single-handedly coordinated the entire initiative, made our lives much easier, and the primary reason why we were able to develop and deliver this document in such a short period of time.
Well, thanks to both of you, and thanks to our listeners for joining us on the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We'll see you next time, and we look forward to bringing you more episodes like this to help you actually change how you take care of patients and improve their lives. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.